Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll discuss the current job climate. There was a time when having a college degree almost guaranteed you finding and keeping a job, but no more. We'll talk about that. Being upwardly mobile in Illinois is more difficult than you might think, and some of that difficulty stems from the economic class in which a person was born. A researcher will explain. At one point, Illinois was one of the top producers of bicycles in the country, but a lot has changed. The author of a new book on the subject discusses the booms and busts of the bicycle industry in the state. We'll visit a hair salon that brings relaxation and peace to its customers. And a lot of police departments have purchased new vehicles. How has the typical squad car changed over time? That report and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. College used to be a reliable path to a professional career. Now facing an increase in layoffs and a difficult job market, some workers say it's not enough. Chicago Public Media's Sasha Ann Simons on her show In the Loop learned more about why it's happening and what it means for both workers and the economy.
At the table is Noam Scheiber, a New York Times reporter based in Evanston. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Mutiny, The Rise and Revolt of the College-Educated Working Class, which is out in April. And Sarah Rand, who's a communications consultant who has firsthand experience with this very issue. Welcome to In the Loop.
Great to be here.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
So, Noam, I'll start with you because this trend of college-educated people experiencing long-term unemployment, it's continuing. What's driving this?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery. We've just never seen long-term unemployment this high when the overall employment rate is actually not too bad. The unemployment rate's about 4.4%. It's not, you know, historically fantastic, but it's not terrible. And yet, we've seen long-term unemployment, which generally means 6 months or longer, really tick up in the last year or two, and especially among people with college degrees. So it's been a bit of a mystery for economists. I think automation is always looming, and for decades, obviously, that was something that affected blue-collar workers, and college degree was supposed to insulate you from automation trends. And certainly we've seen with the rise of generative AI that more jobs are automatable, but the trend actually precedes Gen AI. I think it's something that we've really seen for the past 10, 15 years. And I think a lot of it is kind of pre-AI automation. So you have spreadsheets and you have accounting software and you have HR software. And these are all jobs that college-educated people have done for many decades. And as the software has gotten more sophisticated over the past few decades, it just, you know, little by little, it started to kind of erode some of the demand for college-educated people that has historically been very strong. So I think it's a kind of gradual automation story that's now been supercharged by AI.
And you talked a little bit there about some of the recent trends we've been seeing on the job reports. Talk about the comparison for folks without degrees.
Folks without degrees still have a higher rate of long-term unemployment than folks with degrees, but that has the gap has really been narrowing. So I looked at some data going back to the late 90s, and the difference between folks with degrees and without degrees is the smallest it's been for the past 30 years. So
again, so everyone's on a almost level playing field
exactly.
at this point.
It's really close. For many years over the past few decades, the long-term unemployed or the people with college degrees were long-term unemployed at about half the rate of everyone else. And now it's more like 70%, three quarters the rate. So it's really starting to narrow, and it's just not the case anymore that a degree insulates you from this.
Let's bring you in, Sarah.
Yes.
What's been your recent experience with this job market?
Noam, a lot of what you're saying resonates for sure. Last spring, my husband and I found ourselves laid off from our jobs within a few weeks of each other.
Both of you.
Both of us, which was pretty shocking and something we were not expecting. We had felt insulated. We had college degrees, myself a master's. We had stable employment for almost 20 years. Suddenly, the fields we were in felt under attack. I worked in academia. I've also worked in nonprofit and research institutions. These are sectors of our workforce that are facing real challenges from the current administration. It's felt different. It feels like the job market is very impenetrable. It feels like there's a lot of AI involved. It's seeing job postings with over 1,000 applicants, submitting job applications that feel like they go into a black hole, going through job interview processes that can drag on for months and require really extensive interviewing and requirement to do tasks. Mm-hmm. It's a really taxing experience.
A lot of people applying for these jobs,
yes,
too, right?
Yes.
Some of these job postings are seeing, 1,000 people apply?
Yeah.
And so how do you stand out among 1,000 people?
Yes.
And it sounds like your degree alone is not going to help.
That's right.
So talk to us about some of the changes that your family's had to make, I imagine, to accommodate.
Yeah. It's been a low spend year, is one way we're thinking about it. We've had to really think about how we're adjusting our family economics. The caregiver that we had hired for our kids, we had to reduce her hours. We got rid of a car and simplified our finances. We had been planning to do a home renovation project that is very much on the table or off the table right now. Mm-hmm. There are causes that we would like to contribute more to, especially in this time of great need. And we're not able to do that in the same way. And just really scrutinizing all of our expenses on a daily basis in a way that we are surprised to have to make those kinds of choices.
Yeah. And one caveat that you make throughout an op-ed that you recently mm-hmm. wrote in the Sun-Times, sharing your personal story, is, this is new to my husband and I.
That's right.
But we're well aware that this has been a reality for others for quite some time.
Yes. Yes. It feels like, yes, this is a new experience for us, for college-educated folks, and, seeing what the lower class experienced this fall with decline of SNAP benefits. It's a new kind of instability, and it's just made us realize how fragile our ecosystem is, how precarious our social safety net is, relying on employer-provided health care is challenging when then you don't have an employer to provide that health care. So it feels like a precarious system.
And Noam, you've, of course, been following this for quite some time. So Sarah's story sounds quite familiar, I'm sure.
Yeah, unfortunately, really familiar. Everything from the job application process, which, as you guys said, is feels almost like an arms race. It's because of the use of the AI, employers are not personally vetting applications. And so workers feel like they then have to use AI to increase their odds of getting an application through the vetter, which then increases the number of applications and causes employers to use AI more. And then it just kind of keeps cycles that way. I think, if you step back, one advantage that people who have a college degree have traditionally had is standing out in an application process. I know how to write a good cover letter. I know how to write a good resume. I have good references. I can really talk up my work. But now that everything is being vetted by algorithms, it kind of flattens those advantages and you just don't stand out the way that you did before. So I think that's really causing a lot of stress for college grads who sort of knew how to navigate this old world, this kind of human interaction world, and in this algorithmically mediated world. It's just not sure where your advantage lies. Yeah. I think that's led to a lot of confusion.
And as we think about who's most impacted here, recent reporting shows college-educated Black women. They are seeing a very steep drop in employment, and it's been pretty steady over the past year, and more than other groups. So, more than other women, more than Black men. What do you think is contributing to this, Noam?
Yeah, I mean, there are a handful of things, but we do know that Black women with college degrees are disproportionately hired by the government and especially the federal government.
Yes.
And so the freezing
They're overrepresented in the federal labor force.
So the freezing of hiring and the aggressive cutting of federal government jobs, I think, has really disproportionately hurt that group. It's a group that kind of, when the economy turns, tends to be hit harder, faster. And when you layer on this reduction in government jobs in particular, it's going to have this disproportionate impact, unfortunately.
Hey, if you just got here, welcome. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop, your space for context, community, and conversation every weekday morning at 9 a.m. here on WBEZ. Now, college, it used to be a reliable path to a professional career. And now, as they face an increase in layoffs and a difficult job market, some workers are saying a college degree is just not enough. So we're digging in with Sarah Rand, who's a communications consultant, and Noam Scheiber, a New York Times reporter. So how are you approaching the job market differently now, Sarah? Given all of these factors, what does your search look like? Are you doing what Noam just described and, and use an AI to help beef up your cover letter and your resume to catch the eye of these employers?
Great question. And a little bit of that to try and game the system when I can. But I've pivoted. And that's what this moment has really required. I did the submitting jobs into the black hole, found that not very productive. I've worked my network as much as I can, and I do have a great network here in Chicago that's been very supportive. But I've pivoted to working for myself. I've hired myself. I am running my own consulting business, doing strategic communications.
Congrats.
My husband also is doing the same, working in food systems and building food businesses. And I guess we've sort of stepped back from the traditional job search process and are approaching it in a very different way.
Because that in itself is a full-time job, is it not?
No question.
Applying for jobs, it's like literally you wake up at nine and, and you almost have to like get dressed and get to the computer and just sit there.
Sarah and I were actually talking about this earlier, even more so than usual, because what we're finding is a lot of employers are actually having candidates do work, like do work that they need done. Write a program, write a memo, write a report. I've heard of lawyers looking for jobs where they're asked to write legal briefs and contracts. I mean,
only to eventually possibly tell you that you don't have the job.
No, typically to tell you that you don't have the job. This is just part of the application process. And we're finding that employers are using it to get free labor, essentially.
Imagine a world where you would get paid for just being part of the interview
just
process.
Just being an interviewee. That's
right. That would be lovely.
Yeah. So it's been a time of creativity and resilience and Noam and I were talking earlier that for a lot of organizations that I work with, it can be really hard to commit to a full-time role, an FTE of an employee. So offering myself being able to support them on a contract basis is much more easier for them to justify that expense. And it's been a great experience to work with clients across Chicago and nationally and maintain my professional muscle and make connections and continue to do the work that I love to do.
So a question for you both. Do you think that college is still a good investment, despite the rising cost to get a degree these days? Noam, you want to go first?
Yeah, I think it can be. I think the difference between today and, say, 20, 30 years ago is 30 years ago, just getting a degree, you didn't have to think too much about it beyond that. You know, just having that degree gave you this sort of wage premium. It just set you on this path for success in your career. Now there's just so much more differentiation. You have to think about what degree, what school, what industry, what moment. And if those things don't align, it can actually be a not a great investment.
Right.
In my book, I write about a group of people who got degrees in video game design. And this has just been an explosive major across the United States over the past 20 years or so.
Wow.
And that's great when, you know, there are a lot of video game companies hiring and there's a huge demand for video games, but it's a highly cyclical industry. And in the past few years, it's been cutting jobs at a really rapid clip. And that's just not a very good investment for you in today's market. So you have to ask a lot more questions today than you did a generation ago.
And what's the psychological impact here, Sarah? Just trying to job seek right now. How do you keep yourself motivated?
Well, again,
I mean, you've made a pivot.
It was the pivot. Was
before that, though.
Before that, you know, I think we are consistently hopeful and looking for opportunities where we can apply our skills and be productive. And it just sort of takes a resilience and approach that, you know, got to keep doing every day to try and find a good opportunity. And it just takes that consistent optimism.
Noam, what do you think this all means for the future of the middle class?
It's a great question. I think that the way we think about class is changing. I think it used to be, you know, when I graduated from college in 1998, which is a very long time ago, probably, you know, arguably the best or one of the best years in history to graduate from college. People my cohort thought of themselves as just on this glide path to a professional career or to a management career. You didn't really think twice about it. And I think now when people graduate, they have to think, you have to kind of think about every detail of the process. You know, what is my entry-level job going to be? What's the next step look like? What's the step after that look like? And I think they're increasingly finding that there isn't this sort of glide path to a professional career. Mm-hmm. And it's making them think that they are less sort of part of this elect or this sort of special caste, and they're just workers like anyone else, you know? And I think that kind of worker consciousness is in some ways good, sort of eroding these differences that college people used to see in themselves and other people. Instead of thinking, oh, I'm part of this special group,
yes,
now you're starting to think, well, maybe I'm just part of this kind of bigger group of workers, and my interests are actually pretty similar to workers in vastly different industries. You know,
right.
I remember talking to a group of doctors a few years ago while the auto workers were on strike. And doctors are a group of people who've very rarely unionized, and they are a part, you know, they're a very special caste of workers. And they were telling me how they thought of themselves as auto workers on some level. And one told me that he even took his kids to a UAW picket line because he wanted them to see what it meant to kind of walk a picket line and be a worker. So I think we're seeing these kind of barriers eroded between different fields and different professions in a way that might be positive on some level.
And so I want to wrap this conversation by echoing your piece on suntimes.com, Sarah. Just what's your message to government officials? What are they missing in this conversation?
That's a great question. I think at the basics, we really need economic transparency. Last summer, we saw Trump fire the Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioner after weak job numbers came out. I feel like data sources are being eroded. And just at the basics, we need to have the numbers. We need to know what's happening. We need to see the reality. Mm-hmm. And I think this will just give us a clear picture so we can hopefully put in place some improvements for the job force.
That's Sarah Rand, a strategic communications consultant, and Noam Scheiber, a New York Times reporter based in Illinois. They spoke about college degrees and how many people are finding a degree is not enough to ensure and keep a job. They sat down with Sasha Ann Simons. This is Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Bicycles were once a top export from the state of Illinois. According to a new book, manufacturing centers in Peoria and Chicago made two-thirds of all bicycles sold in the country in the year 1898. That changed a lot in a series of booms and busts. Chris Sweet is a librarian at Illinois Wesleyan University and author of the book, A History of Bicycling in Illinois. In this interview with Charlie Schlinker, Sweet says in the 1890s, bicycling was a national activity, second only to baseball. It was brought on by the entry of so-called safety bikes with two wheels about the same size.
Once that design changed, kids were riding, women were riding, men were still riding in huge numbers, and it became the socially elite thing to do. So bicycling became incredibly popular, 1890 to about 1900.
And when did it crash, and why?
The easy answer that people jump to, right, is the rise of the automobile. But when you start to look into how many automobiles were actually being produced, it gets a little bit more complicated. So my opinion, it really was, it became no longer the socially cool, popular thing to do. The bikes became cheaper. Anybody could get on one. It kind of lost its allure for some, and they moved on to the next fad, which was motorcycles, then automobiles.
So how much did it decline in cost?
About early 1890s, one of those safety bicycles, you would be looking at about $100 in, you know, 1890s dollars. Sears and Montgomery Ward got into the business and drove prices down like crazy. You get one for about $20 by 1900.
So democratizing the availability killed it off.
Yes. Once the average shop worker, minorities could get on there, all of a sudden it became less desirable to show that you were, you know, as a status symbol.
You make the case in the book that Illinois was a big center, big hub. Why?
A number of reasons, some that you would expect and some that you might not expect. So Chicago is already a manufacturing center. They were very good at building all sorts of things. Factories could flip in a matter of a month and move from making like an agricultural implement to making bikes. And some did choose to do that. So there was already the infrastructure there and the know-how about how to build things. That was part of it. easy access to raw materials, right? You need a lot of iron ore shipping down from the Upper Peninsula. Now, for bicycles themselves, one that people might not think of is simple topography, especially around Chicago, very flat. And they also invested in better roads than most places. So those two things together, right? Early bikes only had one gear. So if you were in a mountainous area, they were not very much fun to ride. But if you were in the Chicago area, you could get away with a single gear and have a pretty enjoyable experience. And then this investment in roads, Chicago did a lot of woodblock roads, early types of asphalt, and that made the riding experience better.
How did bicycling and the boom connect with the good road movement?
Prior to 1890, roads in the United States were haphazard. Generally, all rural roads were the responsible of the adjacent landowners. So if a farmer felt like investing in the road next to his property and keeping it up, he could. But they, you know, very deep ruts, unpassable sometimes in the spring. And cyclists were so passionate about getting out there and getting people to be able to ride into some of these rural areas, they started lobbying both the federal government and state governments to build better roads. Bicyclists drove what is known as the Good Road Movement, and the bicycle companies invested in this. They lobbied Congress in order to have the first highway administration. This Good Road Movement then allowed motorcycles and automobiles.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Chris Sweet, the author of A History of Bicycling in Illinois, 160 Years of Booms and Busts. What are some Illinois firsts in bicycling?
There was this thing called U.S. Census of Manufacturers, and this was a gold mine when I found it. It reported to the U.S. Census Bureau the output of different factories. And so this gave me an across-the-board, some even data to look at other states. We were indeed the first and the biggest as far as manufacturing bicycles. So that was a big one. There's a number of ones that people would be maybe surprised about. The first banked bicycle track. Another one that will make a little splash in the very small bicycle historian world is that Illinois was the location of the first six-day bicycle race. Six-day races are originally just what it sounds like. The cyclists, as individuals, rode as far as they could over the course of 6 days. Sometimes there were teams, sometimes it was done as an individual. The first one of these occurred in Chicago. It was indoors, so you can imagine riding inside on a very tiny track and just going and going for days. They became big spectator sports.
Illinois and Chicago also had the first pneumatic tires and the first bikes with multiple gears. Peoria had the Luthi Bicycle Company, and it had a couple of other bicycle significant items in it, and Bloomington had a bicycle company. Why Central Illinois?
Peoria was the second biggest city in the state behind Chicago, and in the later 1800s, they weren't all that far behind Chicago. People kind of forget how big Peoria was in relationship to Chicago. The reasons are much the same as the ones I said earlier for Chicago. Peoria had a big manufacturing hub already in existence, so they were able to move some of these factories very quickly into bicycle manufacturing. In some cases, it was a side business for like a watch company. One of the interesting that Peoria was known for is what was called high art bicycles. They went after the high end of the market. So think about like very intricate filigree work on the bicycle lugs, the pieces that connect the frames together. Some really interesting crank designs. Lots of nickel plating on the bikes was as a way to kind of stand out from everybody else.
So those were Luthi Bikes and Rouse Hazard and Company.
Sure, those are the big ones from Peoria.
In what ways did bicycling facilitate or inflect social change?
Women and gender issues would be first and foremost. During this boom period of the 1890s, it kind of aligns, right, with the progressive era when women's rights and suffrage were big topics, as well as prohibition. This is all wrapped up in sort of the progressive era. Bicycles come along at the same time, and women really embrace the bicycle as a means of emancipation. Many men really wanted to bring women on along on the rides, right? To involve them in some of the club rides, to get their girlfriends and their spouses out riding. But you know what doesn't work very well when you're trying to ride a bicycle is these big Victorian skirts, right? This drove dress reform, the bloomer style of dress, a split skirt essentially, but it allowed women to ride and to hopefully keep those the dresses out of the chains. So this is all part of the bicycle story.
How did the development of bicycle technologies affect the early automobile industry? You spend some time in the book on the Duryea brothers of Canton and Peoria.
If you haven't heard that name before, it's well worth looking up. The Duryea brothers, it was Charles and Frank, they both were involved in the bicycle industry to start with. Charles has a number of patents, quite a few patents to his name, and also built some bicycles in Peoria. But the reason that we know them is not their bicycle history. It is certainly their connection to the American automobile industry. The Duryea brothers had the first mass-produced automobile is their claim to fame. So their story is kind of exemplary, right? A lot of people went directly from bicycle manufacturing to automobile manufacturing. So some of the technologies are very straight transfer from bikes to cars. Ball bearings were developed for bicycles. Differential gearing was developed by bicycle manufacturers. Some manufacturing processes, if they weren't developed, they were perfected. So industrial stamping, using great big presses and drills to do mass production of pieces of bicycles, that led directly to some of the early assembly lines for automobiles. We mentioned pneumatic tires that give some cushioning and traction that was developed by bicyclists and some of the same tires. Bicycle tires were used on some of the early cars. This line is incredibly direct.
Chris Sweet is a librarian at Illinois Wesleyan University. His book, A History of Bicycling in Illinois, is available from the U of I Press. And he talked with Charlie Schlinker. The town of Macomb, like many others, purchased some new squad cars last year. That led reporter Rich Egger to wonder how the vehicles have changed through the years.
Like with so many other things, the technology for squad cars has advanced by leaps and bounds.
The technology in here allows officers to do so much more than we were 25 years ago.
Chief Jeff Hamer joined the department in 2001. He says back then, dashboard cameras were new, and they were big and bulky. They even blocked a bit of an officer's view looking through the windshield.
Now what we have are HD cameras. They're much smaller. In fact, the one in here is smaller than a smartphone, about half the size. And then the hard drive is all the way wired into the trunk. So none of that equipment is kind of blocking your view.
While dashboard cameras were new in 2001, the use of body cameras was still a few years off. Now those cameras are synchronized through Bluetooth.
So when we activate our emergency lights to pull over a car, not only does it turn on the dashboard camera, but it also turns on our body camera. So that's less buttons for the officer to press or forget to press. And so it kind of makes a more consistent recording environment.
Hamer says that also helps the officer focus on the vehicle they're pulling over and the people in it instead of thinking about activating their body cam. The chief says officers today use military-grade laptops in the field with faster speeds and better processing than equipment at the turn of the century. Officers can easily take them out of the car and carry them right to a crime scene to take notes, photos, and video. In addition, squad cars now have articulated mounts for the laptops, allowing them to be adjusted according to each officer's height and preference. Changes in squad cars extend beyond the driver area. Hamer says the back seats of squad cars are designed differently now, too.
Now what we have is a kind of a crafted prisoner compartment that's made specifically for prisoner transport.
Hamer says some of the vehicles have seat belts that belt to the door side of the rear cabin. This means officers don't have to reach across a person's face or chest to get them buckled in, and that helps them avoid possible hazards presented by someone being arrested.
Especially if they were a little bit combative or if they had airborne illnesses and things like that. We were thinking of safety on all fronts.
And instead of heavy gauge metal, a plexiglass shield separates the front of the car from the back. The vehicles look different from the outside, too. In the late 90s, Macomb police drove the streets in white four-door sedans with blue lettering. Now they drive black and white SUVs with black and gold lettering.
So SUVs sit higher up in traffic. We're able to see more. SUVs are popular. The prices come down on them over time. So not only can we see more, but it also holds the equipment a little bit better and a little more room for the officers and anybody else riding in the vehicle.
Hamer says SUVs are the vehicle of choice for most police departments, though some rural departments opt for pickup trucks. The Macomb department has 10 marked squad cars and another half dozen cars that are unmarked or for other uses, such as for DARE officers. They rotate out two cars every year. Each car costs about $55,000 to buy and equip. Hamer says equipment such as cameras and laptops can get reused. The chief says today squad cars handle better and include more safety features than when he joined the department. And he says with advancements in technology, the equipment is smaller, more rugged, and longer lasting. Rich Egger reporting.
Having someone else wash your hair can be a relaxing experience. One Rockford creative is digging deeper than her customers' roots. Yvonne Booz visits a salon to check out the vibe.
A loctician is a person who twists or coils hair. When these sections are not manipulated or washed over time, they turn into locks. The style is called locks because the individual coils fuse together. The twists are done by hand or with styling tools. The fusing process can take weeks or longer depending on the person's hair. It's normally been worn by Black people, but other ethnicities also wear the style. The smell of incense floats in the air at Inner Strength Therapeutic Lock Services off Broadway Street in Rockford. The lights are dim and the walls are plastered with art, including a large image of a woman with long, stylish locks. Purpose Simba is the owner of the salon. She sets the mood with soothing music. A fish tank sits near the waiting area, and there are books for people to enjoy as Simba preps. On this day, Asia Price lays back in a chair and rests her head on a porcelain wash bowl. Simba runs the water and waits for the perfect temperature. She wets Price's hair, adds shampoo, and starts to move her fingers up and down while saying positive words and prayers.
Take a moment to envision all of your stresses and worries going down the drain. For indeed, everything always works out for you, so there's no need to stress and there's nothing to worry about.
Price visits Inner Strength every 6 to 8 weeks.
Every time I leave here, I feel like a weight has been lifted off my shoulders. Like, just being able to vent and, like, someone that understands and... She's just like a really like warming personality, and she's easy to open up to, for sure.
Simba ran away from home at the age of 14 because she says it was a toxic environment. But her salon reflects something totally different. The peaceful atmosphere gives Simba a chance to relax, something she couldn't do as a child.
I didn't get whoopings for no reason, but I got whoopings for everything, and the whoopings were way more extreme than the actual... You know, like, I've been hogtied with ropes. I've been, like, the execution style with paddles wrapped in duct tape and extension cords. You know what I'm saying? Four leather belts wrapped in rubber bands. Like, oh, my God.
Despite that tumultuous experience, she says she knew she was destined to be a light for others. And she got that chance at Hartgrove Hospital, a psychiatric facility in Chicago.
Running away is considered endangerment to self and others. So I've been hospitalized, too. And when I was hospitalized at Hartgrove at 14 and 15, they had me leading the day groups, you know, like the group classes, you feel me? Like, I give my insights and I touch on things that they were actually going to speak on, so they just give me the floor.
Simba is from Chicago, but says she enjoys Rockford because it's much slower. Her salon space is a low-key environment. There are two wash stations, but Simba normally has one person in the salon at a time. This gives her the opportunity to connect with the client. It's the kind of place where a client might drop in just to say hi.
Just having this space at all for myself where I don't have to share with other stylists or other people that's not like-minded, it's therapeutic on its own because it's just me and the client, you know? And it's real, it's genuine, it's authentic.
Simba says her goal is to make the salon a one-stop shop for all things that promote healing. Herbal remedies,
massages, and whatever magic, as she calls it, that comes from her God-given gifts. In Rockford, I'm Yvonne Booz.
And releasing all that no longer serves you, and in season, Ashe. Ashe is the affirmation of power.
We'll talk about upward mobility in Illinois. That's next on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A study suggests upward mobility is more difficult in Illinois than many would think. Although educational attainment and career choices have the biggest influence over a person's income potential, the economic class in which they're born also plays a role. It was the topic of a recent Capital Cast from Capital News Illinois. Peter Hancock brings us this conversation.
America is the land of opportunity. That's what we're told from an early age. Here, it's not supposed to matter where you come from or how humble your background is. If you work hard, study hard, and apply yourself, anybody can grow up to be whatever they want. A doctor, lawyer, a titan of industry, or even president of the United States. At least that's what we're told to believe. But a new study suggests that here in Illinois, the state where Abraham Lincoln rose from rail splitter to president, climbing the economic ladder is not an easy task, especially for women and people of color who are born into lower-income households. The study is called Precarious Prospects. It was conducted by the Illinois Workforce and Education Research Collaborative, or IWORK, along with the Discovery Partners Institute, the University of Illinois, and the University of Chicago Consortium on School Research. Here to talk about the study is a researcher who has appeared on this podcast before, Sarah Cashdollar. She is Associate Director of IWORK and a lead author of the report. Sarah, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great to be talking with you again.
Okay. So this study follows a cohort of, I guess you'd call them millennial generation students, from high school through post-secondary education and into young adulthood. We're talking about the graduating classes of 2008 through 2012. So I guess that means they were born between 1990 and 1994-95. First of all, what were you trying to find? What were you looking for by looking at this cohort of students and young adults?
Yeah, I really like how you introduced the podcast because we were also, you know, interested in that question. Is the American dream still achievable? Does someone born into a low-income family have opportunity to become upwardly mobile? And if so, is the best route still a college education? I think that especially is on many students and families' minds these days. And so we wanted to know, what are the outcomes of students born into low-income families? And then what are the trajectories, you know, that got them there?
And so, bottom line, does college still matter? Because we hear a lot these days where high schools are becoming increasingly focused on career and technical education, and they're told that students are told that a four-year degree is not necessarily vital to having a prosperous career in the future. There's a lot more emphasis on getting industry certificates or different kinds of training that might be short of a four-year degree. Is a four-year degree and presumably, you know, graduate or professional degree after that, are those still valuable in the economy?
They are. The primary route to upward mobility that we saw was a college degree, and specifically that four-year degree. We saw that there was about a $30,000 earnings gap between those who had the bachelor's versus those with just a high school. And there was also a pretty steep gap between those with a bachelor's and the next highest level, which was associate. And it, you know, the bachelor's, it pays off for students of all economic backgrounds. That said, it wasn't the only pathway toward higher earnings. There were programs of study and industries that were higher paying than others, even for students with less education than the bachelor's degree. So we can talk about some of those if you want. CTE is actually another research area of mine. And, you know, historically, when we look back to when it was called vocational education, we thought of it as being separate from a college pathway. But CTE today is designed to be very much about college and career readiness. Part of the idea is that you know, work-related learning can be very motivating and give direction and engage students in academics. And yes, it can lead to careers that don't require a college degree, but for the most part, I think it's about preparing for all types of education and training.
So what are the best degrees to have, and what are the most lucrative fields? And remember that you're talking to a former political science major who went into journalism. I don't expect you to mention either one of those. But generally speaking, if you were advising a high school student today, what are the best degrees to have, and what are the most lucrative fields that you found?
I would say it depends on the degree level you're looking at. So for certificates and associate degrees, we see higher earnings for construction, for mechanic and repair technologies. So these are things like auto mechanics, HVAC techs, electricians, and also precision production. So this is like manufacturing. These are all areas that tend to have unions, and they also have been experiencing higher demand due to lower supply in recent years. And so there's some upward wage pressure in those occupations. And then for the bachelor's, there are many, many industries that offer higher earnings. Two of the highest earnings were engineering and computer and information sciences. And then separate from, you know, so the fields that those degrees prepare students for tend to be higher earning. And then we also saw utilities in general as an industry. So things like power line installers, wind turbine technicians, other utilities were very high earning.
Okay. And so in this study, you have this very large cohort of students that you looked at from those years that I talked about, and you know what sort of economic background they come from, as well as other demographic factors, their race, socioeconomic background, gender. How hard is it for someone who is born into a lower income family or who grew up in a predominantly lower income community to get into college, graduate from college, and then go on to look to one of those higher paying careers?
Yeah, our data show that it's rarer for students from low-income backgrounds to go to college and get that earnings payoff, but it's not impossible. The question is, like you said, how do we support them in taking these pathways? And I would say we've made really great strides at improving college enrollment. There are still disparities, but the vast majority of the students in our study did attend college. A really big issue is college persistence. So more than half of the low-income students in our study started college but didn't finish. And that's a huge contributor to the earnings disparities we see. So why is that? We actually have done a project with the Latino Policy Forum in the past that looked at some of those challenges for Latino students and others in accessing and persisting in college. And we found that college readiness, starting, you know, before college in K-12, financial aid, family expectations, issues with navigating the college environment, these are all things that can make going to college and persisting in college harder for students from low-income backgrounds. But there's also a lot of people doing really great work in this space to provide solutions. So our partners at UChicago have a project called To and Through that looks at supports for college access and persistence. And there's many other organizations like Partnership for College Completion, Advance Illinois, Braven, who are doing this work as well.
Okay, so the study, documents kind of the income differentials between people who go to college and don't go to college, who earn degrees, don't earn degrees, different kinds of degrees. But it also finds that even among people who achieve similar levels of education and who go into similar fields, there is still a gap between those who come from upper income families and those from lower income families. And I'm wondering, you know, we've heard, you know, for years about income disparities and wage gaps based on gender and based on race. Are we just looking at the same thing here through a different lens, or is there an actual kind of class-based disparity where people from lower incomes, lower income families or backgrounds are just sort of steered into lower paying jobs?
I think that the racial and gender disparities obviously are real, and there's a lot of research showing that. But I don't think it's all that's going on. This is not something that we looked at directly in this study, but there is other literature that can help explain it. And so one thing is that the same degree, such as a bachelor's degree, can have a very different payoff depending on the college that the student went to. And there's research that's found students from higher income families are more likely to go to colleges that have things like many internship opportunities or other work-based learning, more advising, more networking opportunities. And for some fields, those things are essential to landing a good job. There's also research showing that higher income students have greater access to social networks in general that can provide those connections. What's not going on, which I thought was really interesting, we did not find that students from lower income families were choosing majors or fields of study that were lower paying. They had, you know, they were going into majors with similar expected earnings. So, I think it's about providing opportunities for those supports that some colleges have, but some don't, that could make a difference.
That part is interesting because we do know that for many years, and maybe this hasn't entirely gone away, students of color were often steered away from professional programs. They were told, you can't be a doctor, you can't be a lawyer, you can't be a scientist, you should go into some sort of labor-oriented job. Women were often told the same thing. You should think about becoming a secretary rather than a corporate executive. Sometimes it was subtle, sometimes maybe even not so subtle. And I'm wondering, is that same thing still going on today, or is there something else, some other kind of barrier that is preventing women and students of color from achieving the same kind of future earnings?
I think there definitely is a legacy of that type of messaging. And like you said, it could be subtle, or it could be covert, but students are still internalizing ideas about what a person who looks like them or comes from their community can do based on what they see. But I do think it's more than stereotypes. Costs are a big factor. People are more skeptical than ever, I think, that a college degree pays off. And a lot of that skepticism, again, comes from those who start college but don't finish. And so maybe they've paid tuition or they've taken out loans, and they have to pay that back, but they don't have, you know, a job based on the degree that they were going for that could help them pay that back. So those who have the debt without the degree, I think, are really struggling. And again, we saw that this was really, really common.
Okay, so despite all of this, and you mentioned this at the beginning, some people do manage to climb the ladder. They do come out low-income, disadvantaged backgrounds. They go on to get college degrees. What do we know about those people who actually succeed in navigating the system in order to, you know, climb out of lower-income background?
I'm glad you asked, because that is actually the topic of the next report that we will be putting out in this series. But to give a preview, we found that there were pathways at all levels of education toward higher earning careers. But they were predominantly concentrated in bachelor's degree pathways and even higher master's and doctoral and professional. And so stay tuned, and we'll have more detail about that.
Okay. Well, Sarah Cashdollar, Associate Director of the Illinois Workforce and Education Research Collaborative, or IWORK, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Peter Hancock with that episode of Capital Cast. It's a production of Capital News Illinois. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us and join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.